Hello everyone. Welcome to episode number 15 of our series in which we have been focusing primarily on one critical aspect of end times Bible prophecy, based upon the series we have titled the Bible Prophecy Masterclass. In this study, part 3 of our addendum of studies, our chief aim is to continue in the appeasement of our curiosity surrounding the who of Magog and the why of God's hostile attitude toward that land and its end times leader. As usual, the text for this study is Volume 2 of the series called Judgment Day, Israel Catapulted to Global Superpower, subtitle, A Muslim's Nightmare, the writer of said series being Mr. Alvin Mitchell, and, I am Liam, your affable host. Please feel free to join us as we invoke the blessing of God upon this and all of the studies to come in this highly informative and instructive series. Sarmatians. As with the Sumerians and with the Scythians, so with the Sarmatians, their past comes to us sealed in a shroud of murkiness. Some light is shed on that past, however, as they are first mentioned in 1st century AD Roman literature, referred to there as Alans. Old Roman maps point to them and the areas of their occupation interchangeably as either Alans, Josephus 7.4.3, 7.7.4, or Geloni, Herodotus. Ptolemaic maps are said to reference those same areas as Sarmatia. Another source document detailing something of the presence and reach of this people is an ancient Parthian manuscript known as the Vologeses inscription, while one of the richest sources of knowledge is the many graves, found and unearthed in the regions they inhabited. It is generally thought and accepted that the Sarmatians were nomads of Iranian blood who undertook migration from Central Asia between the 6th and the 4th centuries BC. Arriving eventually at the Ural Mountains, apparently following an ideology and strategy, or a route plan similar to that of the Scythian, several centuries earlier, and who in some sense, are near relatives of theirs. By the 5th century BC, control of the plains between the Don River and Urals was their domain. There were at least three separate groups, each of which while maintaining some form of unity, developed independently along the steppe between the Ural Mountains in the east and the Danube River in the west. The 4th century saw them attempt expansion of that domain as one of their several groups, the Alans or Alani, some say, crossed over the Don, to challenge and discomfit the now settled, and, maybe, complacent, less threatening and, unsuspecting, Scythians, virtually wiping them out according to one source, over 200 years, thereby establishing themselves as the rulers of southern Russia, by the 2nd century this in spite of the Scythian superior numbers. In the 1st century, they formed an alliance with the tribes of Germany, which was formidable enough to be a threat to the mighty Roman Empire. The reality that says, all good things must come to an end, however, began to set in, when, after almost 300 years, apparently having turned on their German allies, the Sarmatians sought yet again to expand in the 3rd century AD, only to invade Romania, then Dacia, and the lower Danube River region to be overwhelmed by the Goths. Many of them went on to join the Goth invasion of Western Europe, while their homeland was sacked in 370 AD, demolished by an influx of Huns from the east. By the 6th century, history had lost track of its third consecutive group of savage plundering, ravaging warmongers. Following the drubbing administered by the Huns, the remaining Sarmatians fled into Gaul, Galatia, with other groups known as the Vandals and the Suebi, 406 AD. Some settled in the general area of Orleans and Valence, while most however entered North Africa alongside the Vandals. Those who chose to remain in the vicinity of the western Mogojan steppes are believed to be progenitors of, and therefore live on even today in, a people of the Caucasus Mountains known as the Ossetians. They actually view themselves as an amalgamation of Scythian and Sarmatian. This is probably not without justification, according to some authorities, given careful consideration of their linguistics. Spoken of in terms of diaspora, a large number of the Ossetians are said to live in Turkey, and beyond, all around the world, including the USA, Russia, France, Sweden, Syria, and Canada. Like the Sumerians and Scythians before them, the Sarmatian in battle was a virtual killing machine. Like the Scythian, he was a mounted soldier, and a master of his mount. Instead of the bow, however, his chief weapon was a long pole, 15 feet, or a lance, upon which he used bone for a tip, instead of iron or metal. He also made use of bone for the tips of his arrows. For armor protection, he is said to have creatively woven together the hooves of horses, slaughtered for food, and for sacrifice to their fire gods. These hooves were split and fitted to some sort of backing material, leather, I believe, in an overlapping fashion similar in appearance to the way fish and snake scales overlap. They were held in place by sinews from horses and oxen. This type of armor, worn by both the soldier and his horse, is heralded as having been as attractive and as durable as that of the more civilized Greeks, made of metal. In addition, the Sarmatian made fine use of a version of man's best friend, known as the Great Dane, which is known to have always been by his side. This was slash as a large and powerful dog, utilized in attacks on an enemy's horse, an idea of a concept which, in some sense, might be construed as a primitive forerunner to the modern RPG, highly effective at disrupting, disabling, if not dismantling slash dismembering or destroying enemy transportation. Such a force was he, and, so impressive and poised in battle, that the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius made the near-fatal error of upon discomfiture of their Jaesig and Roxolani divisions led by the Alans at the hands of his troops, during his share of a bloody 250 years of conflict putting a large contingent, legion class, 175 AD, in charge of the guard protecting that flank of the empire exposed to possible attack from Britain's Picts. The big mistake, in this picture of course, is trust, for in time the Sarmatian demonstrated that though he was the latest in a string of three tribes known for being hellishly savage, time and civility had coalesced only to lose nothing on him. He is said to have been more primitive, more cruel and brutal, more defiant and combative than either of his predecessors on the steppes. So dangerous, deadly, and untrustworthy was he that after several defeats at the hands of Pompey, 66 BC, Caesar, 47 BC, and Emperor Trajan, 102-106 AD, granting him freedom and space in exchange for a risky alliance, as did Hadrian, following his ascension to the throne in 117 AD, was deemed preferable to attempts at containment. The cost for this type of risk management was the loss of one legion, apparently completely, XXI Rapax in 92 AD, and the near total loss of several others as the Sarmatians broke the constraints of their alliance with Rome for the protection against Britain. Yet, for all this, their cavalry had been considered an invaluable asset in Rome's strategic defense initiatives in Saxon territory. Just as combatant as valued at his side as his dog was his equally aggressive woman, or wife, whose bravery was noted as having been easily a match for that of any man. The great many graves said to have been examined, the most elaborate of which have been found in a region known as the Kuban, indicate that many of these warrior women were more highly decorated, as it were, than many of their men. Ultimately, their tombs, weapons and horse trappings tended to be less extravagant than those of the Scythians. Side note. In addition to the aforementioned Alani, the Roxolani, and the Jazigs, it appears, according to one source, that the modern-day Serbs and Croats may be remnants of the Sarmatians, which might help to partially explain the recent Milosevic attempted genocide. In habits, customs, and daily life, these nomads were, by some accounts, essentially animals. They are known to have effectively lived on the backs of their horses. Owing to their degradation and lewdness, Roman historian Tacitus saw in them a peculiarly disparaging people. They drank Mara's milk, with a mix of horses' blood. While females were very young, babies, according to Herodotus and Hippocrates, in preparation for their roles as warriors, their mothers applied red-hot instruments, specifically constructed for this purpose, to the right breast so as to destroy its tissue, thereby permanently stunting its growth. The belief was that this would transfer strength to the right shoulder and arm. Another hideous, heinous practice among some divisions of the Sarmatians was the intentional deformation slash elongation of their skulls, probably, some think, by squeezing the skulls of babies, while the cranial bone is still relatively soft, with a soft cloth. Since they are not known for having ever cultivated the habit of erecting permanent structures of any kind, not even the more settled groups among them, they are said to have lived or spent the entirety of their lives out of doors, without shelter, of any kind. This in contrast to the Scythians, who appear to have been the first to employ the services of the covered wagon in their nomadic divisions, as they lived in strong felt tents. Historian Pausanias is said to have observed that, as a rule, they had no friendly dealings with their neighbors around them, except of course, for opportunities of plunder and for the entertainment of alliances with the likes of the Dacians, Romania and the Marcomanni against Rome. There are apparent strong indicators, such that, in early Sarmatian society, women ruled the roost, in contradistinction to God's punitive injunction stipulating that the woman was to defer to the men, see Genesis 3 verse 16. In those days, young, unmarried women, their right breast already removed for this purpose, were not only required to take up arms alongside the men, marriage for them was forbidden, until they had killed a man in battle. It is thought that Greek knowledge of this bizarre custom may have given rise to the Greek tales of Amazonian tribal, warrior women. A huge percentage of all the military graves thus far exhumed are those of these women, buried with their weapons. They are said to have been seen frequently hunting with their husbands, dressed in identically the same type of garments. For whatever the reason, however, in the end men did dominate. The similarity of his origin, habits and culture, to that of the Scythian must have been recognized early on, so that it was, after the conquest, easy for the two savages to set aside whatever their differences, thus promoting assimilation and integration, in contradistinction to their relationship to their Roman conquerors, whom they obviously detested, sorely. Not much is known about how religion manifested itself in or, how it impacted, the Sarmatians' life. Like the Scythians, they were definitely not men of God. Unlike the Scythians, who were more or less polytheistic, the Sarmatians are remembered for devotion to a god of fire, to whom they offered up horse sacrifices. The floodgates of hell. Following the demise of the uniquely distinct culture spun by these three barbarian groups, whose individual presences collectively dominated the steppe scene for roughly 1,600 years, the Sarmatians alone for 800, plus another 200, before their name joined ranks with their physical disappearance from history, in around 600 AD, there came a flood of other nomads, equally as savage, if not more so, than the one preceding, some even more needlessly destructive. Their existence on the Russian steppes was as if the gates to the pits of hell itself had been blown open, releasing as it were what appeared at first glance to be humans, some having the hearts, minds, and drives, the same thirst for wanton bloodletting as that of something lower than the most savage of animals. In addition to the Slavs, the dominate group even to this day, there came Balamir and his Huns, who with the German Goths, old friendships and alliances decimated by Sarmatian instability, vanquished and quite destroyed the Empire of Sarmatia. The following will give a brief description of some of the more notable of these invaders and their possible link to the identity of Gog and Magog, as well as why God would find them so repulsive. The Gothic invasion. The Goths are said to have first entered the area around 100 years after the death of Jesus Christ. Unlike their savage predecessors, they did not come from Asia. According to Gothic historian Jordans, they appear to have been from among a Scandinavian group of diverse peoples, known in his time to have had a fighting spirit, marked by a cruelty akin to that of a wild animal. Interestingly, Jordan seems to imply that their heritage was traceable to the biblical character Magog, who was one of the descendants of Noah, via his son Japheth. Following the flood, his high appraisal of Jewish historian Josephus appears to have been cut short by his perplexity as to why he did not include this observation in his otherwise highly regarded works. Led by King Berig, the Goths began their intrusion into mainland Europe by settling into northern Germany, after displacing and driving the Almoragi from their abodes. These were a seafaring folk who inhabited the area at the time. Five kings after subduing their neighbors, the Vandals' Gothic numbers having experienced a significant increase, the need and search for space led them to the land called Scythia, then dominated by the Sarmatians, where they encountered and prevailed over the Spalae, near the Pontus, or Black Sea. Once there, they quickly spread throughout the whole of the old haunt of the Scythians, and were generally successful even against the fearsome Sarmatians, pushing them back past the Don River until their thirst for more brought them face to face with the Romans, 267 AD, south of the Danube River. These were the Western Goths, or Visigoths. Those who settled near the Caspian Sea, east end of the Black Sea, became known as the Ostrogoths, Eastern Goths. Though a bloody and dangerous neighbor to have under any circumstance, that which made the Goths most feared by the enemies they made was their custom of human sacrifice. It seems that in the early days/years of their arrival, anyone taken in battle was sure to be served up, alive, apparently, to their war god, Tyr. Through shaky alliances, occasionally violated by both sides, it was his ruthlessness in battle that made him a valuable asset to the Romans. Following their first war embrace, during Rome's declining years and its struggles to keep the empire intact, an additional, or token offering was made to this same god using captured weapons. The Goths are also known to have honored mythic kings as those among their gods. The Hun invasion. The opening chapter, around 350 AD, for the Hun presence on the Russian steppes was led by Balamir, or Balamber, crossing the Volga River and wearing down the Alani through incessant, repeated assaults. Jordan's notes, as he draws from the annals of a historian named Orosius, that when the Huns arrived, all prior notations and connotations attached to the term fierce had to be scrapped, as the definition of the word required reinvention. So fierce, so cruel, and so horrible were they in battle, for which they appear to have been uniquely psychologically and emotionally prepared, having no other skill except hunting, that even the bloody and murderous Goths and Alani could not stand before them. While they looked like men, their cruelty too was on a par with that of wild animals. Even the Ostrogoths found them frightening, and the Visigoths were forced to seek solace in their on-again, off-again alliance with the Romans. Like the Goths and the Celts, they are known to have practiced human sacrifice, in which the captured among their enemies were offered up to their apparent god of victory. The remainder of the conquered was forced into subjection. Without benefit of any formal education, the Huns are said to have been physically of short build, quick of both mind and body, able horsemen, and outstanding archers. Cultural achievements were relatively low, compared to some of the people they were able to subdue. Nonetheless, this did not impede their effort to bring the mighty Roman Empire to its knees by 432 AD, putting even them to a shameful, heavy tribute. By 451 AD, the most noted of the Hun leaders had been defeated in Gaul, thereby bringing an end to the tyranny and domination of the Huns. Attila appears to be worthy of honors at the top of the list of the most ruthless, hellish, and heartless of all the nomadic leaders of that era, having murdered his way to the top by killing off his own family members, including his co-regent brother Bleda, who, with him, assumed the reins of leadership following the death of their uncle Roas. Before his death in 453, this last and greatest, and most gruesome, of the Hun chiefs was even venerated as a god by the politically savvy Khazar king Caradoc. The Khazars are said to have first appeared on the steppes of Magog as part of the Huns. In addition to the custom of human sacrifice, the Huns are said to have begun cruel preparation of their young males for war at birth, slitting their cheeks with a sword, so as to teach him the endurance of pain, before he received his first drop of milk. Thus, in appearance, initially dark-skinned and Asian, which alone was enough to strike terror in any foe, the faces of all young men were scarred, having cheeks attached to shapeless lumps, marked by pinholes for eyes, perched atop firm-set necks, ever proudly erect, between broad shoulders. Absorption and assimilation with other European tribes permanently blurred those original Hunnish Asian features over time. Invasion of the Avars. These were a Mongolian people who made their nomadic debut on the Russian steppes, near the Volga River, with the conquest of a Turkic tribe called the Uyghurs, in 461 AD. These two peoples formed a federation which was almost completely decimated by the Turks in 550 AD. This drubbing caused them to split, so that half remained in Eastern Europe while the remainder migrated to the Danube River area, where they later established a kingdom reaching from the Baltic Sea to the Volga River, from whence they came, having enough power to subjugate the empire of the Byzantines, extracting heavy taxes from them. Led by their king Bayan, they were possibly the greatest power in Europe by the end of the 6th century, and are credited with being the driving force behind the current locations of Slavic peoples today. The death of King Bayan ushered in the collapse of the Avar world, as Slavs and the Bulgars seized the moment, weakening the kingdom. More crushing defeat came at the hands of Charlemagne in 795-96, but the death knell was delivered by the Moravians, virtually, completely annihilating them. Although many who survived these onslaughts saw assimilation into the Slavs, those in Eastern Europe are believed to be the ancestors of the modern Avars who live on today in the Caucasus Mountains, as one of 27 tribes called Lezgians. They inhabit Dagestan, Russia. Under the leadership of a great warrior named Shamil, the people of the Caucasus revolted during the 19th century, as they struggled for freedom from the Russians. He was an Avar. The Khazars. Genghis Khan, we remember, Attila and his Huns, Alexander the Great, the Babylonians, etc. These and other great names we all recall, whether or not we really cared that we actually remembered. The Khazars, who flourished as a separate kingdom during the 7th century after Christ, are said to have managed an authority and influence equal to or greater than that of the Romans or Greeks. Largely forgotten, misplaced, and overlooked by time and history for centuries, it seems, somehow, they were once long dismissed as myth, due in part to claims of its having been a Jewish kingdom. During the 1930s or 40s, however, huge amounts of evidence are supposed to have surfaced confirming their existence. It is, or was, a mysterious kingdom credited now with having set the tone for the world in which we live today, to a degree that is as astonishing as it is alarming, some authorities say, and with sculpting both the historical and political landscape of Europe, as well as Western Asia. The acreage covered by Khazaria, making it at that time the largest single state on the planet, stretched east to west across roughly 2,150 miles between Austria/Hungary and the Aral Sea, east of the Caspian Sea, approximately 420 miles inside the western border of modern Kazakhstan, and north-south from the Caucasus Mountains to the upper Volga River in the north, roughly 1,000 miles. Adding to the mystique and fascination surrounding these newly unearthed relics encoffined in the darkness of centuries past, is the notion that there is direct linkage between the roots and existence of modern Israel and this people once thought to have never existed. So, who are they? What were they? How might their reality resolve or contribute to a solution of the riddle as to why God would risk/endanger the lives and livelihood of his people whom he promised to personally resurrect from the ash heaps of time, in the last days, who have just recently been restored to the land by bringing against them an overwhelming, dangerous, and potentially destructive force out of the north parts? As is typical of the majority of the nomadic barbarians who graced the Russian steppes, not much appears to be known with any real exactitude regarding where the Khazars came from. It is thought that historical records indicate that they are a blend of Mongols, Turks, and Finns, and who emerged as an identifiable, distinct group by the 3rd century AD. Thus, they were a Turkic, mixed, people, who originally robbed and plundered as part of the Huns. They are described as a race Caucasian in complexion, tall, of large build, with blue eyes, having long, flowing, permanently reddish hair, who considered black hair an evil sign. In terms of overall demeanor, they were known for being of a cold nature, and wild in appearance, of a fierce countenance, extremely brutal in their dealings with their fellow men. Consequently, they were regarded, simultaneously, with great fear and abhorrence by all under their dominion. Even the Byzantine or Eastern branch of the Roman Empire was careful to exercise extreme restraint and diplomacy in its dealings with them. But for their presence north of the Caucasus Mountains, it is thought that, following the death of Muhammad in 632 AD, the Islamic Caliphate, the Muslim caliphs or leadership's armies, would have had easy access to Eastern Europe via the Caucasus, in which case Europe today and the rest of the world at large might be a strangely different place. It was they who had the greater hand, therefore, in saving Europe from Islamic slaughter and tyranny, more so than Charles Martel, as is commonly taught, or so the story goes. For a duration of 150 years, their presence helped to check the advance of other Eastern nomads pouring into the Russian plains. Okay, my friends. We will end this edition of the podcast at this juncture. Please tune in again next time for episode number 16, where we will continue our discussion of the many diverse people groups that have contributed in one way or another to the making of Magog, modern-day Russia, right here in the Bible Prophecy Masterclass. We look forward to your presence. Until we meet again, take care and may God bless you.